On this edition for Sunday, July 12th, coronavirus cases continue to climb across the country. More on Roger Stone's sentence commutation. And one city's attempt to curb residential waste. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular has been offering no-contract wireless plans designed to help people do more of what they like. Our U.S.-based customer service team can help find a plan that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us. As new coronavirus cases continue to increase in dozens of states this weekend, reopening decisions are being reversed, and in some parts of the country, officials are urging people to stay at home again. There were more than 60,000 new confirmed cases yesterday, according to data compiled by the New York Times, a more than 50% increase on average over the last 2 weeks. And confirmed infections are increasing in 37 states. The surge in coronavirus infections comes as school districts scramble to figure out how or if they can reopen. Today, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos continued to press for in-person instruction, despite Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines that say if children meet in groups, it can put everyone at risk.
The CDC guidelines are just that, meant to be flexible and meant to be applied as appropriate for the situation.
Questions about returning to school come as Florida reported 15,300 new coronavirus cases today, more than any state has recorded in a single day since the pandemic hit the U.S. Earlier this week, bars in Florida were closed to prevent the spread of coronavirus. But Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has resisted instituting a statewide mask mandate. In Louisiana, Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards announced yesterday he was requiring residents to wear masks outside and ordering bars to close. Louisiana was an early hotspot for coronavirus, and the state has seen daily cases rise to levels not seen since early April. Today, White House Coronavirus Task Force member Admiral Brett Girouard said completely shutting down again is not necessary and supported bar closings and mask wearing.
Our models really show that if you close down bars where there's a lot of transmission, if you decrease restaurant capacity to about 50%, that you really strictly physically distance, and really everybody, if you're out in public, we have to have about 95% mask wearing or face coverings. If we do just those simple things, we can bring that R value, that transmissibility value, down to below one, which means it goes away.
More than 3 months after the CDC first recommended wearing a face covering, President Trump wore a mask in public for the first time yesterday during a visit to Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. Mr. Trump previously declined to wear one, arguing that he's regularly tested for COVID-19. But many critics have argued that it sends an important symbolic message reinforcing public health guidance that face coverings are an important tool to prevent the spread of the virus. One day after President Trump commuted the sentence of his longtime friend and former campaign adviser Roger Stone, former special counsel Robert Mueller defended his investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 election and the prosecution and conviction of Stone. In an opinion piece published last night in the Washington Post, Mueller said he broke a long silence because he felt compelled to respond to claims that, quote, our investigation was illegitimate and our motives were improper, and to specific claims that Roger Stone was a victim of our office. President Trump has repeatedly called the investigation a witch hunt and a hoax. Mueller also said, quote, Stone was prosecuted and convicted because he committed federal crimes. He remains a convicted felon, and rightly so. Stone was found guilty of 7 felonies, including obstructing a congressional investigation, lying to investigators, and witness tampering. Joining us now for more on the president's decision to commute Roger Stone's sentence and the reaction from special counsel Robert Mueller is Ryan Goodman, a professor of law at New York University and co-editor-in-chief of Just Security. Ryan, we've heard a lot of people over the last 24 to 36 hours talk about whether or not this was appropriate. What are the kind of longer-term consequences legally from the president doing this?
So the longer-term consequences in terms of what the law actually allows are pretty significant. So in a normal universe, one would think that this could be impeachable conduct and that Congress would mobilize around it. In the current universe, there's potentially a prospect that the House brings a censure resolution, so you can censure the president. It's very rarely used, so that it does have some symbolic significance to do that. And lastly is one has to think about a future Justice Department. So a future Justice Department could look into this as an exercise of the obstruction of justice. Bill Barr, when he was nominated in his own hearing, said that a use of a pardon to get false testimony would be a criminal offense.
Look, this is in the context of a pandemic, a re-election season. We've already been through an entire impeachment process. Does Congress have the stomach for this?
Right. That's the word I was going to use similar to. I was going to say, I don't think there's any appetite. There's no appetite on the part of Speaker Pelosi, especially given the situation that we're in. And we just ran through this. And now, with it being that close to the November election, there's a very sound argument that the voters will be able to decide for themselves.
Why now? Why not when the sentence was handed down in the first place?
That's a great question about the timing of this. If anything, that's the biggest surprise to me is the timing. I would also have thought that the best timing for the president to do this would be right after the November election, whether he wins or loses, because at that point, he's much more politically insulated. And if the news reports are correct that his chief of staff and the attorney general both advised him against the commutation of the sentence, in part on the part of the chief of staff for political blowback reasons, you'd think he'd wait.
Also surprising, the op-ed by Robert Mueller, who took great pains not to make any statements during the investigation, really after the investigation, feels strongly enough that he has to remind us of the felony convictions that exist.
I do think he was trying to reestablish the record here, because in a certain sense, there's been so much disinformation about the entire investigation being a hoax, quote unquote. And he was basically rebutting that by saying, no, this was a well-founded investigation that resulted in multiple convictions. And the other part of the importance of it is Robert Mueller had to step up for the lawyers who served in his investigation because their names have been dragged through the mud when they were really my estimation, just public servants trying to follow the law.
The Department of Justice, the career prosecutors have had great reputations because they work across administrations. They are not party to political appointments. But here we are now. Is the Department of Justice's credibility at stake?
I think so. I think this is a crisis at the Department of Justice. It really is antithetical to the entire purpose and structure of our institutions and the Department of Justice as applying the law equally and neutrally without favor to who might be the friend or the perceived political enemy of the president. And this pulls the rug right out from under a righteous prosecution of somebody who was convicted on all seven counts of lying to Congress. And it pulls the rug also out from the jurors who committed their time and effort to deliberate at this trial and wipes it away in a way that's just never been seen before. You know, as some have said, President Nixon never did anything like this. That's why this is just uncharted territory. And the Department of Justice is rocked. Some have suggested that a normal attorney general would resign. I do think that's the kind of moment we're at, where it's that stark in terms of what's just occurred in the last couple of days.
Ryan Goodman, co-editor-in-chief of the Just Security blog and a professor of law at NYU. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
While the U.S. has the most confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the world, daily cases are also steadily increasing in India, where there are now nearly 850,000 cases, according to the Johns Hopkins Research Center. Several states in India instituted lockdowns, including India's most populous state of Uttar Pradesh. In the last 24 hours, a record surge of more than 28,000 new cases were reported across the country. The surge comes as Bollywood megastar Amitabh Bachchan announced on Twitter yesterday that he, his son, daughter-in-law, and grandchild have tested positive for COVID-19. The 77-year-old actor and his son Abhishek, also an actor, confirmed they are both hospitalized but said they have mild symptoms. In Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is responding today to criticism of his government's handling of the economic fallout from the coronavirus pandemic. At his weekly cabinet meeting, Netanyahu promised immediate financial aid to self-employed Israelis harmed by coronavirus lockdowns instituted in mid-March. He also pledged the expanded safety net would last for a year. Netanyahu's new pledges come after an estimated 10,000 people protested in Tel Aviv last night. Unemployment in Israel rose to more than 20% after the lockdown, and critics say previous pledges of financial help have been slow to come through. In Poland today, there was a strong turnout in the second round of a tight presidential race. Incumbent President Andrzej Duda, a conservative backed by the ruling right-wing party, is seeking a second five-year term. His challenger is liberal and pro-European Union candidate Rafał Trzaskowski, the mayor of Warsaw. Voters lined up early and wore masks and gloves when marking their ballots. Exit polls released shortly after polls closed at 9 p.m. in Poland showed the race is too close to call. Official results are expected later this week. For more on the coronavirus and other national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. With more people staying at home during the pandemic, residential food waste has spiked in some parts of the country. Even before the crisis, 40% of food never made it to people's plates. And once it did, $281 billion of it a year was thrown away. Tonight, we take a look at one city's effort to aggressively tackle food waste, an effort they're betting will help them feed more residents in need and lower greenhouse gases. Special correspondent Allison Aubrey has the story. It's part of a five-part NewsHour series, Waste Not, Want Not, which was reported on before the COVID-19 outbreak.
All right, so we're going to be talking some trash today.
It's the city of Denver's Waste Extravaganza bus tour. And Megan Lane, an administrator in the city's recycling program, is showing a busload of neighborhood leaders where their trash ends up.
When we dig through trash, what we find is 25% of the material is recyclable and 50% of the material is compostable, which is a whole heck of a lot of material. So easily, right, we should be diverting 75%.
Lane explains that a good chunk of our trash is made up of food waste that could be composted. Denver offers curbside compost pickup for its food waste to try to keep it out of its landfills, but participation in the program is low, with less than 13% of eligible homes signed up.
The opportunity for having an impact on the environment is huge.
The city is hoping that more people realize that a good percentage of their trash can be composted, so they sign up for Denver's curbside compost pickup. Charlotte Pitt directs the city's composting program.
Composting is basically taking your food scraps and turning them into a valuable soil amendment. When you put organic material into a landfill, it produces methane because it doesn't have the light and the water and the oxygen that it needs to decompose properly. So keeping it out of the landfill is huge.
It's huge because methane is a powerful greenhouse gas that contributes to climate change. It's 28 times more potent than carbon dioxide. Composting food waste uses water and oxygen and only emits small amounts of carbon dioxide, so its impact on greenhouse gases is much lower. Nationwide, Americans generate around 40 million tons of food waste each year, but only 6% of that ends up being composted. This Denver family has been composting ever since Denver's compost pickup program started back in 2006.
After we started composting everything that could be composted, we saw about a 50% reduction in the amount of trash that we had. So then I ordered a smaller trash bin and, you know, of course, a bigger composting bin.
In Denver, chefs are joining the battle against food waste with an initiative called the Chef's Challenge. The city appoints a handful of chefs to try out composting and reduce food waste in their own kitchens. Jason Burgett is chef owner of a restaurant called The Wooden Spoon.
It was like eye-opening. 63% of our food waste was compostable.
It's all part of an effort to green up what is already a pretty eco-conscious city. Lots of people here in Denver ride bikes and support renewable energy. Now there's an effort to show them that reducing food waste and composting are two of the top ways to really make a difference. The effort is getting a jump start from the Natural Resources Defense Council, a national nonprofit that focuses on environmental issues. They're infusing local organizations that focus on food waste with funds to bolster their efforts. In Denver, the NRDC went as far as funding and staffing a new city government position called the Food Waste and Recovery Program Administrator. Leslie Basins is filling that role.
We're focusing on cities because cities are more nimble. At the federal level, the U.S. does have an overall food waste reduction goal of reducing food waste. But I do think that at the local level is where the change is really happening.
A study the NRDC presented Denver back in 2017 shows how cities that aggressively attack food waste can dramatically shrink unmet food needs, or what's called food gaps, for residents who struggle to put food on the table. By increasing the recovery of the edible food that is normally tossed, the report shows Denver potentially capturing an additional 7 million meals and cutting its food gap in half. Arlen Preblood started We Don't Waste, one of Colorado's largest food recovery organizations. He says having a national organization like the NRDC has not only brought more resources to the issue of food waste, it raises the level of awareness in the community about its connection to both hunger and greenhouse gases.
It provided us with a platform to enhance what we do for the community. And through their efforts, they're asking organizations like We Don't Waste and others to reach further into the community and develop programs that bring food deeper into the communities so those folks that are less fortunate are overcoming food insecurity.
Amid the COVID-19 pandemic, Preblood says demand for their services has nearly tripled.
So when a city takes on food waste, there's a whole chain reaction that happens. Environmentally, if you waste less food, you have a benefit in terms of greenhouse gas emission, which benefits cities who often have these greenhouse gas reduction goals. Then you also will feed more people. And I think in a lot of cities that are struggling with food insecurity, being able to rescue more food is a huge bonus.
But increasing composting could be difficult. Part of the reason, it costs $10 a month for compost pickup, but trash pickup is lumped into city taxes and perceived to be free by most residents.
We're looking to change that model in the future. Right now, we do have to charge a fee, but that's not our ultimate goal because we really want to incentivize people to participate.
And there are other economics at play, too. Colorado has low tipping fees to dump trash because there's plenty of space for landfills, whereas in Seattle, Washington, composting is mandated and costs less than trash pickup, partly because land and landfills are scarcer and tipping fees to dump trash are much higher, about $70 a ton compared to less than $20 a ton in Denver. Despite this challenge, Pitt says she remains optimistic.
Whenever you work on behavior change, it just takes some time. The fact that we're over 21,000 people who have taken the time to call us, decide that they're going to pay for the service, we think that's pretty good progress.
For more than 100 years, the middle of the summer has signaled the Tour de France annual bike race across France. This year, due to the pandemic, the world's most watched bike race is delayed, but there is a heavily watched virtual one going on every weekend.
We look down then on the avatars of the riders in this virtual Tour de France.
World-class bike riders and teams are racing against each other on their own bikes at the same time, often from their homes. And the world is watching them bike and play what looks like a video game. I recently spoke with Eric Min, the CEO of Zwift, the company enabling this virtual tour, and racer Lauren Stevens, a professional cyclist who recently won the second stage of the virtual Tour de France.
As they make their way across the line, who takes it? It looked to me like Lauren Stevens, I think, may well have taken the stage.
First of all, congratulations. You're a winner of the stage of the Tour de France. You don't get to say that very often. Most people don't understand what's happening here. You're riding in Dallas, Texas, where you are now, and you're competing in a virtual race. How does this work?
So our bikes are set up on what we call a trainer.
Think of it like a treadmill for a bike.
And what that does is gives resistance to our bike. So if we go up a hill, it's going to put more resistance on our bike. And if we're going downhill, we'll get less resistance.
So everybody's feeling the hill, so to speak.
Right. The other component is at the crank of our bike where we pedal, it measures our output.
So there's basically a video game representation of you riding in a race against video representations of everyone else. This has to take some getting used to, considering what you grew up doing was riding a bike against real people in the real world.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot different than riding outside.
Riders are racing from all over the world at the same time, some from New Zealand at 2 a.m. Many from their basements or garages. You can see how hard the riders are working, how many watts their legs are generating, and how fast their hearts are beating to do it.
You can't feel your components. You can't see if they're getting tired or if they're slowing down. Everyone's avatars, you know, are look happy and fast and full of energy. So it's a lot of internal motivation in your living room. The other thing on Zwift is you're pedaling 98% of the time, where outside, you know, you go down a hill or you're coming to a stop, like you ease off. But on Zwift, you're pedaling all the time.
Virtual racing means Stevens has had to learn a thing or two. When you got on this platform, you were competing against people who are not pros, but are still pretty good.
When I first got onto the platform is there's people I've never even raced outside, or they haven't even raced outside, and they're racing on this virtual platform. And at the beginning, you know, they're beating me, and I had a lot to learn. It was a new discipline for me, and I think I've figured out a lot of it now.
So they all use some power-ups, and Lauren Stevens is the winner of that stage.
We have the liberty of doing something you can't do in the real world. For example, having these special powers.
This is Eric Min, the CEO of Zwift, the company that connects all the bike treadmills together.
You can go through different gates within the circuit of our maps and collect these random power-ups. And they can make you faster for a short period of time. They can make you lighter. In other cases, it takes away the ability for the riders behind you to take advantage of your draft. And sometimes you can go invisible for 10 seconds and you have to use these power-ups very strategically. And if you know how to play the game, you have a huge advantage over someone who thinks they're just strong. So just being strong is not enough to do well on Zwift.
How many people are watching this virtual Tour de France on television?
We have 20 broadcasters around the world covering about 140 countries, the same broadcasters that would have covered the Tour de France during the month of July is covering the virtual Tour de France. So it's in the millions.
So millions of people are watching what looks like a video game play out. What are you learning from that?
The fact that you can, you know, compete on a global scale from the comfort of your home. The fact that there's no travel and time wasted to get to your events. On balance, it's an incredibly affordable, accessible, global sport that we're creating.
You know, we talked to Lori Stevens this morning, but, you know, one of the things that is hard to replicate is being able to figure out whether that rider next to you is getting tired or not, whether they look like they have more in their legs, or whether maybe you should try to pass them now because this is it. They're weak. They're on the ropes.
We're not trying to replicate outdoor riding or racing. We're trying to create a whole new version of it. It's not a 6-hour bike race. It's a 1-hour race. So it's much more intense. And as a viewing proposition, it's much more dynamic and exciting.
Unlike the real Tour de France, where women only compete in the last stage, these virtual race days all have women's races, same courses, same difficulty. It's something both Min and Steven see as a positive sign. Lauren Stevens still has stages left to race in this year's virtual tour. We wish her well. Last night's women's race was won by Tanja Erath, a doctor from Germany who became a professional cyclist by winning a competition through the Zwift Academy.
It looks as if Tanja Erath has taken the win here.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.